With me now are novelists Michael Doris and Louise Erdrich. They form an unusual partnership in as much as they are married and collaborate on each other's work. Louise Erdrich's highly acclaimed novels, Love Medicine and The Beet Queen, grew out of this collaboration. So did Michael Doris's new novel, A Yellow Raft in Blue Water. Love Medicine won the National Book Critics Circle Award as the best work of fiction in 1984. Michael Doris and Louise Erdrich also share a heritage as Native Americans. She is part Chippewa from North Dakota. He is part Modoc and grew up in Kentucky and on a reservation in Montana. They live in New Hampshire now, far away from the Indian culture they were raised in, but Native American characters and issues are at the center of their fiction. Also, Michael Doris is a professor of the Department of Native American Studies at Dartmouth College, which he founded, and is the author of several nonfiction books on Native American culture. Michael Doris and Louise Erdrich have five children, three of whom Doris adopted as a single parent before he was married. Welcome, both of you, to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
I thought we could get things off to a lively start if I asked you who is the better writer.
Oh, great question.
Only kidding. But I am interested in hearing about how you collaborate. I know that you both collaborate on each other's works, yet some of the novels are under the name Louise Erdrich and others. Well, this new one is under the name of Michael Doris. So what's the collaborative relationship like?
Well, the person whose name is on the book is the person who wrote the draft. And generally the way it works is before a book is written, we will talk about the characters, talk about the plot, figure out who these people are, and then the one who's going to have their name on the book will begin to write it. It might be a paragraph, it might be a chapter, and then give it to the other person who will go over it with a red pencil and put some stars and some exclamation points and some no's and some develops and maybe suggest a word here or there. And then it goes back to the original person who makes some changes and argues about others and back and back and back until we achieve consensus on every word. And then we read it out loud to each other one last time and send it off.
But the characters are development of what you've both thought. You work out the story and the characters together.
We do, and it's great. It's great fun in some ways. It probably is very different from what most people consider the writer's task, the lonely task of the writer. Sitting and we tear our hair out, of course, over the writing, but the plotting is something that is such an exciting part of our lives because we can talk about it anytime, we think and plan and talk about the characters and figure out who they are.
Can I ask how come both of your names aren't on the novels? Michael, I especially wonder if you didn't feel a little left out when Louise's first two books were receiving all this acclaim and, you weren't listed as a co-author.
No, not at all. As a matter of fact, I was the agent for the first two books, and so it would have been very difficult to have my name on the book. You can't call up and say to a publisher, we have this hot property and, my name is on it. So no, I didn't. I think there isn't exactly a name for what we do in terms of both cooperating, but in a sense, it's like having a child and we... You read a review and your name isn't on the book, but you know the thing by heart and you feel very proprietary and very proud of it, very indignant if somebody doesn't understand
it. That's true. But there's also a private relationship with, writing the draft itself. And so that's the basis of putting one person's name on the book. I mean, there is that kind of approach to it. We have both in a way.
Mm-hmm. You both write about Native American culture, Native American characters in your novels. Louise, was there someone in your family who was dominant in passing on Native American culture to you?
It's hard to say because in some ways the most obvious person would be my grandfather, who was a tribal leader and truly is one of the admirable people that I've known. But as time has gone on, I think that my grandmother and my mother have been more and more influential, maybe in a quieter kind of way, in a sustained kind of caring for keeping the family together in an exemplary way.
Michael, what about you?
I don't think there was a particular person as much as a community of people. I mean, I think we both write about communities as well as families. And the distinction is sometimes blurred in traditional Native American societies. That is, people who may not be related to you by blood or related to you by history or by incident. And I think both when I was growing up and also I lived in a community in Alaska when I was doing field work after graduate school, where I learned the language and lived for about 18 months. And I think I learned a great deal there, too.
You grew up in part on a reservation. And Louise, didn't you go to a reservation school?
No.
You didn't?
No, I grew up in a small town. My parents both taught at Bureau of Indian Affairs boarding school in this town, Wahpeton.
Oh.
But I went to a regular public school. It's kind of an off-reservation town, and a lot of Native American people from different tribes come there to work at the school.
Michael, you had part of your childhood on a reservation, part of a childhood off mm-hmm. a reservation. Was it a choice of your parents to move on to a reservation?
Well, not exactly. My father passed away when I was rather young, and so I spent some time with members of his family who still lived on reservation. And I think my mother was very anxious for me to experience both sides of my heritage. It's a little bit schizophrenic, but if you manage to pull it together, I think it can be a very rewarding heritage.
It's a paragraph I'd like you to read from your new novel that applies to one character's feelings about life on a reservation. Could you read that?
Yeah, this is in the voice of a woman by the name of Christine, who is 41 years old and looking back at her early life and talking about when she was 15 living on a reservation. She says, "Everywhere else in the world, things were happening. Wars, psychedelic drugs, love-ins, and there we were at Holy Martyrs Mission, still writing themes about whether if God could do anything, could he make a rock he couldn't lift? That kind of stuff. No wonder I was screwed up. You try to make a real world out of what you see on one television channel and what you hear on the radio. You try to put together cute outfits from the secondhand trash from the charity store. You try to have fun when there's nowhere to go and you might be related to every other boy in town."
Did that describe your feelings at all?
Sometimes. Sometimes, for sure. Yeah.
So sometimes an insular life?
An insular life and one in which there was a real distance from what you saw on the media, what you saw America was supposed to be like, and what options were available to you close at hand.
My guests are novelists Louise Erdrich and Michael Darris, and they're both novelists. Her books include Beat Queen and Love Medicine, and his new novel is titled A White Raft in Blue Water. You both went to out-of-town college. This interests me. You both grew up in Native American communities. Your parents both had ties to tribal culture. But when it was time for college, you went far away to New Hampshire to go to Dartmouth. And it's almost like you were shipping yourselves out of your culture.
It wasn't so strange, actually. Dartmouth had and has one of the few ongoing and very stable Native American programs in the country. And that was my reason for leaving for Dartmouth.
Really?
Yes.
Yeah. I had assumed that there wasn't a program like that until you created one, Michael.
Well, that was it.
Oh, that was it. So you went to study with Michael.
Louise and I came to Dartmouth on the same day, actually, in 1972. I came as an instructor, in which I was the instructor chairman, which sounds like a Gilbert and Sullivan operetta. I was chairman of half of myself because I had a joint appointment and there was only a half a person in Native American studies. Which was very easy to have department meetings, as you can imagine. But anyway, we recruited a group of about 15 outstanding Native American kids from around the country. And since then, the program has really prospered. This last year, we admitted 48 Native American students. In the first 200 years of Dartmouth's history, there were only 12 Indian graduates. And in the last 15 years, there have been over 300. So we're very pleased about that. In addition to meeting each other.
Right.
Yes, well.
Well, Louise, you said you went to Dartmouth in order to be at a college that had a strong Native American studies program. But were you so changed by the experience of being away from home that you felt you couldn't go back and live there again afterwards?
No, I went right back, in
fact. Oh, did you really?
I went right back, and I became a poet in the schools and worked with smaller literary presses for a year, and and stayed on another year to travel from town to town and do the kind of poetry school readings with children that the state was funding at the time.
You also were involved in some American Indian Movement activities.
And right. I went back and forth. We've beat a path between North Dakota and New Hampshire and Montana, and over the years it's seems very far away, except that we know everything along the way now, so we go back and forth.
Well, I was wondering, I guess, if your decision to live in New Hampshire as opposed to Montana or North Dakota was interpreted as betrayal at all by your family, you know, who wanted you to go to college there but maybe wanted you to come back afterwards.
No, I don't think so. I think, you know, we're both mixed blood people, and I think there is a certain role to play as a kind of broker between reservation and the rest of the country, and certainly a program like Dartmouth, which has provided the access to an excellent education for such a large number of Indian kids from all 50, well, not all 50 states, but from Alaska to Florida, basically, who have gone and become tribal leaders and doctors and lawyers over the years. I think that is a valid option for us to follow.
I was just going to say that I don't think it's what you might call a definite decision. I think we're very mobile people. In spite of having a very unwieldy family structure, Michael's lived in New Zealand with the children. We've lived in Minnesota with the children. I mean, we're back and forth to a lot of different places. But home base is really a farm out in New Hampshire right now.
Michael, as you said, you're both of mixed descent. What, Louise, what makes you want to identify so strongly with the Native American part of your background? I guess you had a choice. You could have decided to...
I don't think one has a choice, truly. And I think I've identified quite strongly with both parts of my background, in fact. And not really, again, by making a decision, but one's background begins to overwhelm one once you take the step of being a writer. You can't ignore where you're from, where you've grown up, where your people live, where your cadence is. It's part of you, and it's impossible to ignore it.
Did that become more obvious to you after you left home and lived far away?
Curiously, no. Once I came back and began to be part of a writing scene, I suppose, in the Midwest, it became more obvious to me.
Michael, do you feel the same way, that it's not a conscious choice which side of your background you're going to identify more with?
I think it seems that when you're young, it seems that you should be one thing or the other. And if you can resolve the two, and it's a hard process to go through, it sort of adds a complication to coming of age and growing up. But if you can resolve the two, to one's surprise, it works. I got a lovely honor last year, the Indian Achievement Award from the Chicago Indian Council Fire. And I basically gave a speech of apology that I didn't deserve this kind of thing because I wasn't a full blood, and all of these people came up afterwards and said, "Don't be silly, you know. That doesn't matter. It's what work you're doing, who you are."
Do you think that finding each other in New Hampshire, in a community where there weren't a lot of Native Americans, intensified your relationship with each other?
Oh, sure. It would have been intense anyway, though.
Right.
No matter where.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back in a couple of seconds. I have two guests with me, novelist Louise Erdrich and Michael Doris. We'll be back after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Louise Erdrich and Michael Doris. They're married and collaborate on each other's writing. Louise Erdrich's novels are Love Medicine and The Beet Queen. Michael Doris's new novel is titled A Yellow Raft in Blue Water. Michael, you were just telling us that you almost didn't accept this award. You know, you apologize. You weren't full blood. You weren't sure if you were the right person to get it. Is there this kind of almost game of who's more Indian? You know, like how much percentage you are of Native American?
It can happen. One of the characters in this new book, whose name is Rayona, is half Indian and half black, and she finds herself suddenly back on her mother's reservation in Montana and is, in a sense, really troubled by this. She stands out and people kid her about it and so forth. And so, in a sense, her journey in the book is resolving that conflict and figuring out whether she, in fact, does belong there.
It seems that in a lot of ways, many Native Americans are of mixed descent. Is there concern in the Native American community of intermarriage, you know, and of the culture dying out through intermarriage?
I think the Native American community is the misnomer here. We're talking about 300 different tribes,
right,
and it's very hard to generalize from one to the other. I think in some tribes where there is a long, very insular tradition, that it is more of a concern than in others where, such as in ours, in which there has been a long history of intermarriage with French and trappers and various groups of people, so that it's not so unusual.
Have you run into any different preconceptions or stereotypes in the academic world than you did in the town that you grew up in?
No.
I guess one of the things I'm thinking of is that a lot of white people just assume that Native Americans are more spiritually in touch and, you know, have all this wisdom. And there was, I'd even wonder if you'd think that what the hippies' reverence for Native Americans, if you think that that helped or hurt.
There's a wonderful... The chapters, I think, where Lee in A Yellow Raft in Blue Water begins to talk about the outside world, the red power on the reservation, address that to some extent.
By saying?
Well, he, in fact, has a very fascinating and sad, but a powerful reaction to this. He feels that to really... be able to lead his tribe in the way that in the American Indian movement, to come back and be able to be a tribal leader. He is convinced by sisters and friends that he is going to have to be a veteran. And so it's a very ironic twist to his life. He then goes off at the time the war in Vietnam is going on, and I don't want to give away what happens, yeah. But it's a very ironic situation because there's a great deal of respect and honor for one's country among many American Indian people. And in fact, being a veteran is both a great honor, and for Lee, it poses a moral difficulty.
I think, too, in answer to your question, that positive stereotypes can be as debilitating as negative stereotypes. We're all familiar with the savage, Indian, drunk, blah, 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 all of those stereotypes. But those that think that you can walk through the forest without a map and not cry if you step on something that hurts and so forth, all that stoicism stuff is really pretty debilitating, too. And we see it with our kids who sometimes have unfair expectations placed with them. I think if we have a political aim in writing these books, it is simply to present Native American characters as people and not as a kind of polemic, because I think if readers who are used to thinking as either Indians are all good or all bad read these complex lives and say, gee, they're people who have emotions and reactions like other people with a twist, maybe with something just a little bit different. Then the next time they read something in the newspaper about a land claims case or about a water rights case, they can achieve a kind of empathy by transference and think, well, you know, maybe it's Lulu Lamartine in behind this, or maybe it's Marie Cashpaw or Christine Taylor, and see it differently than in a kind of cartoon Halloween Boy Scout campfire girl stereotype of who these Indians are, almost always historic or mythological.
And almost always male, which is interesting, because I think in these books one finds a great many previously unwritten stories of Native American women, and particularly A Yellow Raft in Blue Water, which has three strong female characters.
Well, I think both of your books have really interesting mother-daughter relationships. in them. Louise, you're writing about a part of the country and a kind of people who you've geographically left behind, at least for now. And I wonder if you're concerned at all about future subject matter. A lot of people face this who write about their background or about the part of the world that they're from and then who leave that part of the world. Mm-hmm. Do you think you'll continue to write about the place where you grew up and base your characters on characters who you knew then?
I think so, for a while, although these aren't characters or people that I knew in particular. These are...
Fiction.
Fiction, yeah. Right. But going back and forth, as I say, is a very important thing in our lives. And there's something to the power of nostalgia that I find is almost not there when I am in the area. I think both of us take back extremely powerful images and thoughts every time we go back and stay and visit or live there, and those are to be reckoned with.
And one of the things too is the reaction that we have received back from other Indian people to these books has been so reinforcing. You know, I mean, people even from very different tribes will read it and say, you got it, or, you know, at last somebody is using the kind of language that we speak here on the reservation. Some people have thought it was a sort of linguistic device that we were using, very literary, but what we tried to do is reflect the real speech that people have. And our next book, actually, after Yellow Raft, is a book, nonfiction book called The Broken Cord, which is about fetal alcohol syndrome as it affects Indian communities, but others too. So there's a lot of material.
Novelist Louise Erdrich and Michael Doris are my guests. You have five children, is that right?
Yes.
And three of them, Michael, you adopted before you were both married. It's interesting, I think, for a single man to adopt three children. You were pretty young when you did it. It's not like you knew for sure you would never get married. Why did you do that? Did you think that you'd be married one day?
Well, I sort of expected that I would, but I what I knew is that I wanted children, and I wanted children then, and there was no biological way to do it, and so I explored other possibilities, and then over the next 7 years or so, in fact, it worked out. These are, you know, they're our children in exactly the same way as our younger children, and always seemed such. Yeah.
You have five children. It must be really hard to find time to write. I know that you're both parenting together.
We are.
Still, it's a lot of children, and you both have a lot of work to do.
Well, we managed to organize things quite thoroughly. And I work during the day, and when Michael's also teaching, which we haven't mentioned right now, so there isn't much time right now. But I think when we're back to really working, we'll have some time during the day.
And our older kids help a lot with the younger kids. We have an age span that goes from 19 years to 2 years, and so there's usually always somebody around to help. They're all very close, the kids.
Are you bringing them up in, you know, any tribal traditions? Do you want them to feel very connected to that?
Oh, yes, yes, and particularly to our families. And that's why we do a lot of visiting, going back and forth. And also the community of Native people around Dartmouth College has really actually grown quite a bit because of the program. So there's a number of people with whom we all get along and the kids have as, I suppose, role models.
And traditions are pretty subtle, too. I mean, it isn't just dancing at powwows and food, although that's important, too, but it's attitude, it's sense of community, it's sense of family, sense of sharing, all of those kinds of values, which certainly Native Americans have no monopoly on, but those are positive values in many Native American and tribal societies, which we try and emphasize.
You had mentioned, Michael, that you had acted like an agent for Louise's first two books. Louise, have you done work to help get Michael's first novel published?
Let's see. I haven't done the same thing. I can't say that I have. I mean, Michael didn't just act like an agent. He was the agent, and he is.
I got stationery printed that said Michael Doris Agency with a little italicized over on the right hand Michael Doris, so that when I sent these things out, people thought they were dealing with the top guy in the agency. And it worked.
You were the top guy.
Yes, yeah. That's right. That's right.
So is that a role you're going to continue to take on?
Well, you know, you have to learn a whole vocabulary, and you have to it's very interesting. You meet a lot of people, and you learn how to read a contract and so forth. And having learned all that stuff, it seems like a waste not to continue it. Very easy to get in touch with my client, you know, to discuss things. And so
some people have trouble calling their agent.
That's right. That's right. But so I think we intend to continue that way at least.
Yeah, it is. It's another way we get to see each other, too. I mean, right. It is hard to make time to see one another.
Now that there's a novel under Michael Doris's name, as well as two novels under Louise Erdrich's name,
right.
Louise, can you say what the difference is in your writing styles? You work very closely in planning the characters, but I think your writing styles are pretty different. Could you put that into words?
I really can't. It's a case of being simply too close to both of them. I suppose that's for other people to say.
Part of it has to do with letting the characters take over at a certain point. You know, I mean, I think we're writing about different characters, and all of our stuff almost is in first-person narration. And so once we figure out who a character is, they have to speak in their own voice. So I'm not so sure that the distinctions are as clear in our writing styles as they are the way our characters speak, mm-hmm. and these particular characters speak. We'll see in the next books.
Okay, well, I want to thank you both very much for talking
with
us.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here. And my guests have been writers Louise Erdrich and Michael Doris. They're married and collaborate on each other's books. Louise Erdrich's novels include Love Medicine and The Beat Queen. Michael Doris's first novel has just been published. It's titled A Yellow Raft in Blue Water. It's published by Holt. This is Fresh Air. On the next program, I'll speak with Michael Doucette. He's the leader of the Cajun band Beau Soleil and a scholar of the music indigenous to the Gulf region, so I hope you can join us.